Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulous, the fluoridated, the irradiated. It's just so green, 100% pure plutonium, because we're just opening up all the national parks to mine for it. Of course, my very special guest, speaking about the exploitation of resources, namely human resources, is Kevin Galilee, who is incidentally one of the valuable human resources of the world, who is currently wasting away quite literally. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Well, it's a pleasure being on your show, Vinny, for the third time, might I add. This is our third interview, and I always look forward to being interviewed by you because you're a great host, and of course, your humor is priceless.
Every great host needs a great parasite. Now, wait, did that turn into an insult to you? I meant to insult me. Strike that, reverse it.
I took that as a compliment, actually.
Okay. That's good. We are great parents. In fact, I like to think of myself in the lowest common terms. That way I don't do what every talk radio show host does, take myself too frickin' seriously.
And that way you don't disappoint anybody either.
Including myself. Because, because if you assume you're wrong all the time, ladies and gentlemen, and then you get proven wrong, then you're right. But...
I love your philosophy.
But... if you assume you're wrong all the time and you're proven that, you know, you're actually correct, that you were wrong in the first place, then you're still right.
Now you're starting to confuse me.
Ah, see, this way, it doesn't matter what happens. It's always my fault. And so I don't have to worry about people getting their comeuppance and blame and everything like that. I can blame and punish myself instead.
That's exactly what I'm doing here in Rome, by the way.
Exactly. We blame and we punish ourselves so that we can help other people alleviate their guilt.
Yes.
So
yes, that's a good way of looking at it.
This is your fifth hunger strike, you just told me. When was your first one? By the way, ladies and gentlemen, just to preface the conversation, in case you don't know who Kevin Galilee is, he's a specialist in the depopulation agenda that has been in place since the founding of the UN in, like, what was it, 1945, 46, etc., round about thereabouts. And ever since then, they've been dumbing everybody down and defertilizing pretty much the male sperm and the woman ovum and putting in all sorts of depopulation stuff in many, many different ways to the point where we're all affected by it. Can't escape it, and at this rate, we're going to be dumber than two planks of wood by the end of next century. And some would argue it's already happening.
Yes. This is my fifth hunger strike, and just to put in perspective for your listeners, I'm 48 years old, and my first one happened at the age of 19. Well, at that time, I had just recently arrived in Canada, and I was a landed immigrant, and I was accepted at the University of Victoria to do a bachelor's degree in arts. And I had not received my landed immigrant status, which means that the university was trying to charge me triple tuition fees, which is what they charge foreigners studying in Canada. And I said, no, hold on there. I'm not a foreigner. I'm a resident. It's just because the Canadian government drags its feet with my application, that doesn't mean I'm going to pay a triple tuition fee. So I took a stand, and I went on hunger strike right in front of the City Hall in Victoria, British Columbia. And within 7 days, the government caved in. They sent a person there to say to me, Kevin, you can stop now. We have processed your application. Okay, it's done. Nevertheless, I missed the first semester, but I won the first battle through a hunger strike. And the second one did not happen until 2010. And that was already related to an offshoot of this greater depopulation program. But at that time, of course, I did not know what I was getting myself into. I was only taking on a program of surveillance and censorship. And we discussed that in our previous two interviews, so I don't have to rehash that. But then I did the third hunger strike was in Strasbourg, France. That lasted 30 days. The fourth one was in jail during my second or third arrest, if I remember correctly. The fourth one was in jail again, and that lasted 75 days. It's the longest hunger strike I ever did, and it's a miracle that I survived it. Actually, I don't know how I survived it. But I was in detention as well, pretrial detention, again on false charges as usual, and they put me in a segregation ward, and I was under observation for 24 hours a day, sitting inside a plexiglass cell. So there was no hiding, and they were counting everything, including how many times I was urinating during the day. So there was no way of cheating there. That is recorded, it is chronicled, and anybody who bothers to call the Quinte Detention Center in Ontario, Canada, may be able to obtain the file. And so this is the fifth one now, I'm doing it in Rome, Italy, just 20 minutes walk away from the Vatican, because the Vatican is my target this time. I have tackled, so to say, the secular branch of the New World Order, and now I am taking to task the religious segment of this international order. And the Vatican, naturally, is a very powerful organization. It's been around for 2,000 years, and it has been privy to these secret methods of population control. Since it was accepted, or rather given, observer status at the United Nations. First, it obtained that status at the World Health Organization, which is obviously one of the primary UN agencies in charge of various aspects of the depopulation program, namely adulterating our basic elements of life and finding phony medical justifications for it. That's the duty of the World Health Organization. But the Vatican, having obtained full observer status at the United Nations in 1952 at the World Health Organization, and then a few years later, I think it was 1961, at the headquarters of the United Nations in New York City, it has been, ever since, it has been privy to the methodology employed by the United Nations and governments around the world to subvert our fertility and undermine the family structure, both of which are necessary in order to engineer, or rather carry out, the engineered demographic transition. But because that is how they've decided to defuse the overpopulation bomb, share resources, maintain the peace, and so on. So that's where I am now, here in Rome, 24 days into this hunger strike, and Pope Francis and the Vatican have yet to say a word. I go there every day to St. Peter's Square, which is the large plaza right in front of St. Peter's Basilica, and the Pope can see me from his window because I wear this hand-woven white cotton suit made in India. So I'm very, very visible, and it's, you know, strikingly visible. And I, of course, I'm wearing this on purpose because it has many, many connotations, and because it is visible. And of course, one of the connotations being that Gandhi wore something similar. And Gandhi was perhaps the first human being to have garnered, you know, a very central role in public policy.
Almost as if to say, he's Gandhi, but I'm here now.
Yes. But he wore something like that, and of course he did a lot of hunger strikes, or several hunger strikes. And that was his peaceful way of protesting. And I'm carrying out this tradition. This is a time-honored tradition of peaceful protest. And the reason I'm doing it peacefully, is because I am really giving the authorities, or the elites, if you want to call them that, a last chance to address this and to stop, to address this while we are asking nicely and peacefully. Because I tell you this, if they don't address our complaints, if they don't back off and stop poisoning our children, I will have no choice after this hunger strike is over, and if I survive, and I probably will survive because I'm a pretty tough cookie, I will have no choice but to defend my children by any means possible. And that includes violent resistance. And I will have no hesitation to engage in violent resistance if they continue to poison my children and your children and everybody else's children. We are fully within our right. It is a self-defense. And anybody who commits genocide against us and thinks that they can get away with it just because they hold hands and they lie and they hide between walls of secrecy and deception, they are living a pipe dream, because these very walls that they have built around them to protect themselves and poison us are about to fall on their own heads and bury them alive. And I'm pushing those walls on top of them, and they better move out of the way and get out of our lives.
We always use this term, they, or the New World Order, or the Illuminati, and every now and again you get criticized for what you call these people, right? And we all know who they are and what they are. And I think the only term that actually really is a coverall that kind of covers every base from which you're trying to really communicate is scumbaggery. Because that's ultimately what we're dealing with here, isn't it? It's pure, unadulterated, misfit scumbaggery.
It certainly describes the character of this coalition of the unwilling. I like to call them the coalition of the unwilling, because that is what they are. That is how they came together. That is how they stay together. They're all in it. They are partners in crime. Nobody wants to be in it, but nevertheless, here they are. And they would all love to get out of it, out of the coalition of the unwilling, and I'm giving them now the opportunity to do just that. I'm giving them notice. This is the last notice. They better listen, and they better back off. Anyway, before I proceed with the program tonight, I want to tell our listeners what I intend to discuss. And to put things in perspective, I want to just briefly mention the phases of this depopulation policy, and with the objectives that the international community, or the people in charge of the New World Order wants.
Before we do, could we elucidate on that element about the people that are actually part of the system and are really doing all of these things to humanity as a part, but they don't want to be anymore. And I liken it to getting inducted into a criminal gang as a young man or something of that nature, and you see a lot of crimes being committed by the gang leaders, etc. So if you ever don't want to be part of this gang anymore and you want to go and live a better life, free of pain and suffering and crime and neglect and suffering and all of that kind of stuff, they'll kill you, because you know a whole lot of things that they don't want you ever talking about, and rather than trust you to not open your mouth.
Well, the only people who are fully aware of the program, who have, you know, an overall perspective, are the very people at the top of the United Nations organizations and its various agencies. So the policymakers and the technocrats who have climbed to the very top. Then we have at various national levels, we have the people at the top of the military-industrial complex. But only the very people at the top. All of the others are, you know, in the dark or on a need-to-know basis. They know that they're doing horrible stuff. They know that they're committing crimes. But they only have a very, very sort of narrow understanding of what exactly the overall plan is. Then you have the very top scientists and doctors within the ministries of health and ministries of labor and all kinds of other ministries at the national level in all Western governments, not elsewhere, because most of the countries of the world have been bamboozled into this program. And they have really bought wholesale all of the false medical justifications produced, you know, by the United Nations and by Western scientists and Western institutions and organizations in order to bamboozle countries without the technical and the scientific know-how into believing the lies that they are being fed. And of course, many of the players in these countries, developing nations, who lack the technical skills and the scientific knowledge, they, you know, they like it that way because they don't have to carry the full burden of their consciences. They too have an inkling that what they're doing is genocide, but they don't exactly know how or why, and they justify it by saying, well, this is an international security prerogative, this is in the hands of the United Nations, and if we didn't do it, then we would have to resort to war. And this is better than war. So, in fact, we are preserving the peace. Therefore, at whatever cost, it's better than all-out war or nuclear war or conventional war. So, what we're doing is actually a good thing. It's the lesser evil for the greater good. And yes, there is some truth to that. But
you know, this reminds me of C.S. Lewis quote. Of all tyrannies, one that is perpetrated for the good of its victims is by far the most tyrannical, because those who oppress you will do so without end, with the consistent belief that what they're doing is the right thing.
Yes, that is why these kinds of crimes are so difficult to stop. They are so difficult to stop as they require that the people who are fighting this system, people like us, have to be more persuasive than they are. And of course, we are hampered in our attempt to persuade the public of what is happening by the walls of deception, by the media silence, the mainstream media, who, by the way, is fully complicit in mass murder and crimes against humanity. And one day, and I'm giving this bitter warning to the people in the mainstream media who think that they've secured themselves a safe place in the New World Order and that their families are going to survive into the future while ours are being annihilated. I'm giving them fair warning now that unless they start doing their jobs, they are going to end up in prison for the rest of their lives for their complicity in crimes against humanity. So they are now quietly sitting on the sidelines and pretending that this is not happening, because that is how the system works. It's all a pretense. And they think that as long as all of these people and institutions and organizations and countries hold hands and they all deny, that they can get away with denial. Well, that was possible until about 2 years ago when I published my first book and exposed this policy to the fullest. That is no longer possible now. Over the past 2 years, we have made huge progress in convincing the public that what we say is correct, and that our governments are not to be trusted. And now the trust has been broken. And when the trust has been broken between the governed and the governing people, this trust cannot be recovered unless the governing class is completely replaced. We are going to replace them down to the last one, because none of them is to be trusted, and all of them have have betrayed us and have therefore lost the right to govern. They have broken the social contract, and that is an unforgivable crime. Their reign of power has become illegitimate. You cannot govern unless you are a legitimate government, and you cannot be legitimate if you are an illegal and criminal government. And we are having a criminal government and a criminal international superstructure. Yes, I know the reasons why, and I know the desperate situation they are in, but they no longer have the excuse that, let's say, the administrations of the 60s, 70s, and almost up to the 80s had. Those excuses are gone. The world is a completely different place now, and everything, all the tools necessary are in place to change course, to change from covert methods, from hidden methods of population control, to overt methods, to open methods of population control.
So we're talking about a transition from deliberately poisoning everybody without their knowledge and having unforeseen consequences to people actually realizing how to control their own fertility and things of that nature and just do it to themselves.
Yes, people can merely use contraceptives, you know, faithfully.
And we're only talking about population here, like. But then again, there's abortions and this kind of thing. These are quote unquote terrible but necessary steps, according to the globalists. Oh wait, in fact, I don't even think it's that terrible.
Yes, if we use contraceptives faithfully and carefully, we don't have to engage in horrible things like abortion. You know, I'm not a religious person, but I detest the notion of having to abort my child. And if I won't do it, then I wouldn't expect anybody else to do it. But the technology of birth prevention now is very, very advanced. I mean, we have a gazillion different kinds of contraceptives. All we need now is for the religious authorities to move out of the way, to get out of the way, and encourage the use of contraceptives, so we don't have to be poisoned secretly into extinction.
Here's
so
the problem, though. A lot of those contraceptives secretly poison people.
Yeah, but right now they're doing that because they are they still pursue this plan through.
They're not talking about birth control. They're talking about sterilization.
Yes, that's what they're doing to us now. And of course, when you attack one of the most important, the most deeply rooted physiological functions of the human body, which is the ability to procreate our reproductive systems, and then it's impossible not to damage the entire human organism. And that's what they're doing. They're damaging our entire endocrine system because these poisons that they feed us are endocrine disruptors. And even though that was not their intended consequence at any time, this is nevertheless what is happening. And this health damage to our health is cumulative. It gets worse and worse from every generation.
Yeah, dumber and sicker by the day.
Yes, if time allows, I'm going to discuss, in some detail medical damage. But yes, the damage that they are doing to us is terrible, and it threatens the very existence of the majority of the world's genetic lineages. In other words, our survival is being jeopardized. But now let me put this in perspective. This policy is huge, and it didn't start overnight. Most people are under the false impression that this is something that just started maybe 10 years ago or so, and they don't realize that this is a multi-generational effort. So I'm going to describe now the phases of depopulation. I'm going to describe when it started, what the objectives are of these three phases, because there are three phases involved, and where they're heading with this. Now, because this plan involves the entire world, the sheer magnitude of the global depopulation policy has dictated a gradual and incremental approach that has three distinct phases. And each one of these phases has a primary objective. Phase one, I call it a population control phase, started immediately after the war in 1945. But for most countries, around 1950, because it took the United Nations a few years to get its act together and for the major allied powers to agree on how to pursue this. So from 1950 to 2000, we have this this phase one. It has lasted half a century. And the overarching goal of the depopulation lobby during this phase has been to bring the total fertility rate, the so-called TFR, of every country on Earth down to just 2 children per woman, the so-called replacement level fertility. That means if every couple has 2 kids, then the population neither grows nor decreases, and it stays stable for all times, and therefore countries can live within their means, and there's no need for war. That's the rationale. The rationale is sound and simple. And they've basically accomplished this goal, with the exception of a few countries in Africa.
Oh, I've got a better idea already. Yes. Okay. If you want to prevent war and make it not possible to happen, outlaw financing both sides and enforce it. Pa-ding! No more major wars.
It's funny you say that, because I'm going to discuss the importance of monetary coercion, of the economic aspect of this, right after I talk about the phases of the population.
Proceeds.
To move on to phase two. So phase one has been basically a success. They've accomplished this. The total fertility rate in most countries on Earth is now below replacement level, with the exception of a few countries in sub-Saharan Africa. You have a couple of countries in Latin America and a couple of countries in Asia. But more or less, it's a done deal. Phase two, the population stabilization phase. And that started in the year 2000, so at the beginning of this century. And it is going to go on till about 2040, or at the latest, the middle of the century. And the overarching goal of this phase is to ensure that the global population does not exceed 9 billion, or at the most 10 billion, and that it peaks by 2040, or at the latest by 2050. And that's they deem this necessary because the existing landmass and our technology for growing food does not allow us to feed more than that. And to make sure that this happens, that they stop the global population dead in its track, and it starts reversing from then on. They've fully unleashed GMOs, genetically modified organisms, on the developing world and on the nations of the Middle East and the Gulf of Arabia, to ensure that the goal is reached, that the goal of keeping their fertility low is reached. At the same time, they have unleashed chemtrails on the population of the developed world to make sure that the baby boom generation, which has started retiring 5 years ago or so, that their lifespans are shortened, because during this this phase, this demographic phase, we have now in Western countries and in the developing world, we have a population pyramid where there are more old people than there are young people. So there's not enough workers to sustain this this retired population, and they're crushing all of the social system. So they can't allow the baby boomers to live, you know, for 30, 40 years in retirement. So they're making sure that their lifespans are shortened. That's how desperate the situation is.
It seems to me that none of these people are in control who came up with this plan were raised properly and were never read the story. The woman who swallowed the spider to catch the fly that she'd already swallowed. You know, you just wind up making things worse by trying to control things. You know? In fact, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show .com, sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in Newland and Auckland there, and Blue Shield, as well as a couple of books. The Crowdfunding Revolution is one of them. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere.
Oh, oppression, you prey on us when we sleep. Oppression, you chase after the tired or the weak. Oppression, you know you mean only harm. Oppression, you reach out with your long arm. But oppression, I won't let you near me. Ah, no. Oppression, you shall learn to fear me. Yes, you will. Oppression, you seek population control. Oppression, to divide and to conquer is your goal. Oppression.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Kevin Galilee. Now, I was talking before the break about how we had these unintended consequences, I call them. So like an onion, there's various layers of consequences that are all unintended. And it occurs to me that it's kind of like a snowball effect, like things are getting crazier and worse. And I think this is because you have, as an elected official who has lots of secrets and covert methods of administering your power, you get a lot of it. And in so doing, just like every major dictator throughout history, has gone completely nuts.
Yes, and there's actually a bit more to it than that. You see, they're in a very, very desperate situation, and they're just trying to stay one step ahead of disaster. They're trying to prevent, to preempt disaster. And this is how they manage in justifying these actions, which amount to genocide, by saying, and actually truthfully so, they are preempting even worse. But of course, nobody could foresee in 1945 what would be necessary down the road, 50 years, 60 years down the road, once you've triggered this demographic transition. And this demographic transition, of course, is the attempt to make sure that the population stabilizes, then it reverses and down to a sustainable level. And it's like the best analogy is like forcing a river to flow backwards, because it is a completely unnatural process. And this is why we see now that everything that governments do and the international community does is it makes absolutely no sense if their function would truly be, you know, to aid us, to help us, to make sure that all, to ensure our welfare and our well-being. Of course, that is not what they're doing. What they're doing is they're trying to force this river, the river of humanity, backwards, you know, back to a sustainable population, from a growing population, which is a natural population, to a shrinking population, which is obviously a completely unnatural process. So I was in the middle of describing phase two, the population stabilization phase, which is scheduled to last 50 years as well, from the year 2000 to the middle of this century. This is a critical period because we are being bombarded now from all directions with covert chemical and biological poisons, and of course subverted with psychosocial and economic methods. So we are under sustained attack from every direction. This is also a critical period because fertility rates in the poorest of nations are dropping like raindrops from the sky without being accompanied by prosperity. And prosperity was always used to justify falling birth rates in order to conceal the true reasons for their decline. And this is raising suspicions worldwide. And, you know, many of the demographers are scratching their heads and saying, how the heck is this happening? Those who know, they obviously won't say a word about it until I put it all together and explain it for the world to see.
Yeah.
So now phase three, the controlled depopulation phase, that is going to start around 2040 or 2050, provided that the goal of ensuring the population peaks is reached. And once the population peaks at 9 billion, the full panoply of fertility depressing agents and poisons that we're now bombarded with will remain in place to ensure a steady and controlled decline. Now, how low the population will have to decrease will be dictated by our consumption patterns by our environmental necessities. But judging by how fast the developing world is aspiring to reach Western standards of living, and of course everybody wants to live better and better, everybody wants to reach, you know, Western standards of living, and judging how fast the fossil fuels and freshwater resources are being depleted, it is safe to assume that the global population will have to shrink by at least two-thirds from its peak of 9 billion, so down to about 3 billion. Provided, and this is a big if, provided that renewable energy technologies will be fully engaged in the next 50 years, and provided that the carbon footprint of every human being on the planet decreases to half of what it is today. And it's particularly important that the carbon footprint of Westerners decreases to half of what it is today, because we are the biggest consumers. Now, in the absence of these two accomplishments and of such sparing use of resources and universal use of advanced technology, the population will have to decrease to less than 1 billion if human civilization can halt the destruction of the environment on which its very survival depends. So these are, you know, there's a lot of open questions there, and they're going to act accordingly, depending what the circumstances
will,
are. Technology is.
Will life extension technology exist for the people who can afford it?
Well, that's the last thing they want. What they want is to shorten the lifespans of the baby boomers and not to lengthen them. Once the population is stabilized at the desired level, and it is sustainable, let's say by 2150, and I should have said, yes, I forgot to mention that this third phase will last about 100 years from 2050 to about 2150. So by that time, let's say the population is stable, it's down to about 3 billion or down to a billion, depending on our, as I said, on our consumption patterns and technology. And then they can contemplate, you know, long lifespans. For the time being, that's the exact absolute opposite of what they want. That would be a curse. That would be completely contrary to their desperate program of, you know, of saving civilization and saving the Mother Earth, on which our civilization depends. That's the plan, and it has been pursued, you know, with a great cost in human effort and money. And it is a miracle that they have been able to keep it quiet for this long. That tells you just how much effort they put into this and how few people actually are privy to the entire plan. Because most people are just, you know, cogwheels in this huge international system that has probably a couple of million participants.
I've been debating chemtrails a bit on the internet lately with some people, and one of their arguments was it was impossible for chemtrails to happen because too many people would have to be involved. Well, think about how many people are involved in the general depopulation agenda, and it's only just coming out now, and it's been running for like near on half a century, mate. Okay, all right, trust me, it's more than possible.
And, you know, I'm not even going to regale the cynics with that kind of idiotic questions. It's happening, it's real, it's here, so you accept it.
They believe that as if you're a KFC frontline employee, that you get given the Colonel's secret recipe the first day on the job. Okay, that's what they believe, tantamount, isn't it? They don't give you secrets when you're on the ground floor, mate. Nobody who works for Greenpeace knows what the frickin' top person in Greenpeace is really thinking about or doing, you know? He, if he's out collecting donations from unsuspecting hippies and things of that nature, do you think he knows how to run the entire global organization with copious quantities of resources and contacts and history about it and all of that kind of stuff? No! There's something deeper going on in anything that has a major public face. And if you don't know what it is, try and shut up for a second and learn from some of the people who claim that they do.
Listen, I have no sympathy and no patience anymore for the doubters and the cynics and the, you know, the idiots who won't accept the facts and don't have the courage to stare reality in the face because they're too invested in the system. I'm not going to waste my time with them. They are going to disappear from the face of the earth if they don't listen and read and know how to defend their families, because for the time being, all we can do is, you know, sort of mitigate the damage done to our children until such time as we throw these criminals out of out of power and we take over and we take responsibility over the depopulation program. Because if we take the criminals out of power and we don't take over the responsibility over the depopulation program, we think that God is going to solve our problems or Christ is going to come back for the second time and magically solve our problems, then we're dreaming. Then we might as well leave them in place, leave the criminals in place in power today, because we'd be better off than taking over and doing nothing. Yeah. That's how crucial this, you know, this is. But something that's interesting that I should mention about chemtrails and not this, you know, this doubting nonsense is the following. The use of chemtrails, which, you know, poisons the air, it just shows you that it's in a sense their attempt to democratize death, premature death, because they themselves cannot protect themselves from the poisoning that comes from the air. They have to breathe this air too. And that is how they show the world. Eventually, they will be able to explain, you know, their crimes to the world. They're going to say, "Well, we have subjected ourselves to the exact same methods. We too are breathing the air. Okay, we have not done anything to you that we're not doing to ourselves, because that's how desperate the situation is. Okay, we are all our generation now, that is the baby boom generation. That is, well, the generation before us. Because I'm not a baby boomer. I'm only 48." Who have basically, you know, been involved in this program from the very beginning, or almost from the very beginning, are subjecting themselves to the exact same medicine, because they know that the only way to justify mass murder is if you, even though you are in the know, if you are at the receiving end of the same methods. They know one of these days. This is going to be public knowledge. This is going to be investigated. It is going to be in front of tribunals, and they will have to explain to the world why they've done this. So this will enable them to say, and truthfully so, that, listen, we have not done anything to you that we're not doing to ourselves, because that's how desperate the situation is. So this is the important aspect of chemtrails, not this nonsense denial.
It's interesting. Because that's one of the very reasons why the deniers say that chemtrails don't exist, because why would somebody do that to themselves?
Because these people are not psychopathic murderers per se. What they are desperate policymakers who are saying, if we don't do this, it's going to be even worse. And they've withheld this because they didn't want the population, the general population, to have to face this kind of a decision. Can you imagine if they would have put this to a vote? They would have gone, you know, on CNN and Al Jazeera and all of these mega media channels and said to the world, "Listen, folks, this is what we have to do. We have to poison our air because we have to shorten our lifestyles. Otherwise, the whole social system, social structure, is going to crumble. So can we have a vote? Can we have your approval? Are you okay with this? Do you think that the general population, who doesn't understand dick about, you know, about demographics and about politics and about geopolitics and about the desperate situation of resource scarcity, do you think that they would have said, and of course we also have, you know, half the population who is illiterate, so they would have said, yeah, sure, go ahead, what the heck, go ahead, poison us. No. It takes a tremendous amount of knowledge, first of all, a tremendous amount of foresight, because you have to look into the future. And for the first time, you know, the humankind, the human race, the species, our species, has proceeded into the future by thinking, you know, 100, 200 years ahead and acting accordingly. And not only thinking, you know, generations ahead, with the well-being of generations that are yet to be born in mind, but also with the well-being of the earth that sustains us in mind. Because for the first time, the social construct that we have built from scratch, and that is, you know, wholly independent of Mother Nature, and it is entirely of our own making, for the first time, we have to subject it to a set of rules that considers the environment, considers the planet, considers the future, considers the yet-to-be-born generations. Yeah, this is a leap into a completely different kind of policymaking and ethos. That's why it is so difficult. That's why they didn't trust us with this knowledge. They thought, you know, the common man is just too ignorant and too caught up in his or her own little world to understand.
Well,
you know?
well, as opposed to analyzing themselves as saying, hey, maybe we're completely selfish and self-absorbed and completely irresponsible, and we don't actually really care about these people at all, and what we want to do is maintain our standard of living the way we want it, as opposed to letting the chips fall where they may. We want to maintain control of society like our generations previous have done so. It's kind, kind of like a royal bloodline.
But Vinny, the reality is that whoever is in control, somebody has to be in control within a social system, because we live in society. We don't live, you know, under natural law.
I don't think somebody has to be in control per se. There has to be a middle ground or an equality there between those people who are doing the governing and those who are being governed, to be kept in the loop, sort of thing.
But it's only possible now, because now we have the technology necessary to disseminate information rapidly and cheaply, almost free of cost.
Exactly. So they could technically abandon all of this stuff and de-phase it out, you know, over a couple of decades or so, and gradually inform people about how to get stuff done using the technological developments and abilities that we have to enhance a direct form of democracy where people participate in their own demise rather than having it planned for them without their consent.
You're perfectly correct, and this is exactly where the world is heading, because now the secret is out, and a secret policy cannot proceed without the cover of secrecy. But what I want to talk next about is something that, you know, many people have scratched their heads over, because they can't understand how this depopulation program fits in with the globalization program. And the two of them, of course, are, you can't split them apart. It's like white on rice. One belongs to the other. You can't separate the two. And it's a very complex way in which these two major goals interact. And if you give me the time, I'm going to start explaining, you know, step by step, how this relationship works, the globalization depopulation relationship, which is the axis around which the global community and peace and stability in the world have been maintained since 1945, and which is why they're so reluctant to let go of this.
Considering the United States has invaded like 52 countries since it declared peace in World War II, I'm not 100% sure if things have been entirely peaceful since then, but continue.
No, but we have avoided another world war, and we have avoided nuclear.
But what do you call the world war on terrorism other than a world war by proxy?
Yes, but just imagine, compare this with the sheer destruction and violence of the Second World War, of the First World War.
Which was financed by the same bankers who are implementing the global depopulation agenda. I think it's more like a one-step, two-step, three-step program rather than, we made that mistake, let's do something different now.
No, you know, you're assuming that the leaders of the world and of countries have had full control. It's impossible to have the world under control. Even now, today, with the power and might of the United States of America, and with the international infrastructure that the United Nations has spanned across the globe, even now they cannot control the world. The world is uncontrollable. It's very difficult.
That's not true. Rothschild famous family quote, give me control of a nation's money supply and I care not who makes its laws. It's totally possible to control the world if you control the money supply of the entire world. We have the World Bank, IMF, Bank of England, Federal Reserve, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, all the countries of the world with the exception of North Korea and Iran, and used to be Libya, have Rothschild-owned private central banks who control what policy gets implemented. This is the reason why your depopulation agenda that you've discovered has been able to be put into play, because it's been financed by somebody globally.
I'm glad that you mentioned the Rothschilds and the banking system, because this is where I was going, and I'm going to shatter that myth. The one myth that needs to be shattered is that bankers are in control of the world. And let me start explaining, but you have to give me the leeway to explain this, because it is not an easy explanation. Okay?
I'm going to have to give you quite some time for this, actually. Yeah, we've only got 7 minutes until the end of the segment. Is that going to be enough?
No, but we can continue after in the next segment. Okay.
Proceed.
I want to show that the banking system is actually beholden to political decision makers who are using the power of money or monetary coercion to advance by proxy an ancient dream, the dream of a united world, which is a political goal and a worthy one. Now, having learned from history that international peace and security cannot be gained by conquest, and the two world wars are, you know, were the hard lessons learned in this process, that it cannot be gained by conquest, thus by military means, policymakers since the end of the world of World War II have employed fiscal means to force the world into peaceful cooperation and coexistence. So monetary coercion has replaced military force as the method by which to secure global peace and prosperity, which are the fundamental prerequisites of a one world order. The Europeans, prior to this, you know, mode of thinking and acting on the international stage, they just went around the world and took by force whatever the heck they wanted. That's why they built their colonial systems and so on. So let us get started by going back in time when the political decision was made to put in place a set of rules and the institutions necessary to enforce them, to ensure that nations refrain from taking what is not rightfully theirs. And instead of taking what is not rightfully theirs, engage in peaceful trade with other nations to obtain the natural resources they need to industrialize and to prosper. And that time is 1944, just before the end of the Second World War. And the place is Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. And this is where the Bretton Woods organizations were formed, and of course the United Nations is one. The World Bank and the IMF are the others. Now, at Bretton Woods, what they did is they negotiated a monetary order, and they set it in place. And this monetary order was to govern commercial and financial relations among the 44 independent nation states that participated at that time. At that time, the founding members of the United Nations were just 44 nations, not 193 like now. So this new monetary order that was set in place to govern commercial and financial relations in order to avoid wars of necessity over resources obligated every country to adopt a monetary policy that tied every currency in the world to the U.S. dollar, and also enable it to maintain the exchange rates and to empower the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which was a newly formed institution, to bridge any temporary imbalances of payments. Because in the past, they had run into trouble. Whenever there was trade between nations, sometimes nations wouldn't, the debtors would not pay the debt, and of course, that led to conflict. So they did not want to repeat that. They had to find a way in which to make international trade or trade between nations as fully functional, as smoothly functional as, let's say, going to your local market to purchase tomatoes and potatoes. So it was by this political decision, order was made from the chaos that previously reigned on the international arena with respect to how nations access vital resources that are found outside their territories, not inside. And when nations start industrializing, and that's what happened towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, all of these Western nations were rapidly industrializing, and they were fighting for the same resources. They wanted access to oil and coal and steel and metals and so on. So by ensuring that everyone pays for the resources they need rather than take them by force, as was previously the case, the European model that led to two world wars, peace was secured. And to be able to pay for resources that rather than take them by force, a system was created to recognize the value of each national currency and to facilitate trade between nations by allowing international financial transactions to take place as orderly and as smoothly as national financial transactions. So that's what Bretton Woods accomplished. It was the first and most important step towards an integrated global economy. And ever since that time, the economic aspect of the international community, of this new world order, has become far more important than the military aspect of it.
And even more than that, since the removal of the Glass-Steagall Act, they've become even more powerful.
Oh, yes. Yes. Now, let me continue with the history of this because it's extraordinarily interesting, you know, and it will remove so many misconceptions. It will make people, it will enable people, our listeners, to put things in perspective, to know how this has evolved, how this plan has evolved.
And we will continue doing that just after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Galilee is my very special guest. Back in a minute.
Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
Kevin Galilee. Kevin, keep going, mate. I'm very keen.
Yes. Now, the Bretton Woods order gave the U.S. dollar a central role as the currency of global trade. There was no such thing before. To engage in international trade, every nation needed from that moment on to buy dollars before it could buy goods, resources, or services from other nations. And the U.S. dollar was became the reserve currency of choice, the international currency. And the United States, as a result of that, needed to print more money than any other nation on earth in order to satisfy the global demand for its dollars, which was necessary for all these international transactions. But this proved to be a problem because every dollar issued had to be backed up with gold, as was demanded at that time by the so-called gold exchange standard, which was also agreed upon, by the way, at Bretton Woods. And according to this arrangement, countries fixed their exchange rates relative to the U.S. dollar, and central banks could exchange their dollar holdings into gold at the official exchange rate of $35 per ounce, so that all currencies, in effect, were pegged to the dollar and had a fixed value in terms of gold. So gold, therefore, was the standard by which to measure the value of money and by which to ensure that the value is not diluted. But in time, this is what happened. They ran into trouble because the burden on the United States to back up with gold these vast amounts of dollars that it issued in order to facilitate global trade became too great for the United States. And the U.S. was forced to abandon the gold standard. And since then, currencies became detached from gold, thus from any fixed asset. And these are what we now have come to know as fiat money, which means money with no intrinsic value because it's paper. But all currencies in the world now are fiat money. And there is, you know, I hear a lot of talk nowadays in the alternative media and even among, you know, dim-witted economists about a return to the gold standard. And the evil machinations of bankers who usurped the value of the dollar, who emptied the vaults of the Federal Reserve of gold bullion and so on. But this talk is complete nonsense, and I'll explain why. This, by the way, this talk is complete nonsense because it is nurtured to detract people from understanding the world around them and to blame imagined culprits for the hardships that we are going through as a result of being, you know, in the middle of this the greatest transition in human history, which is a transition from national self-determination to global government and from national economies to a global economy. This is the biggest transition in history. It's unprecedented. And it's never been done before. The notion that fiat currencies can be abandoned for a return to the gold standard is completely retarded, and I'm sorry to say this, for the simple reason that we would need the gold of three planets to back up the value of all currencies, which represent the value of each nation's entire economic activity. It's impossible. Fiat currencies came into being in the early 1970s for the very reason that there was insufficient gold to ensure the convertibility of the US dollar and also the Deutschmark, by the way, which were the two primary reserve currencies of the world, to gold. They could no longer convert these two world currencies to gold. There was just not enough gold to go around. Besides, no single precious metal is available, actually. Nevertheless, gold. No single precious metal is available in quantities large enough to be equivalent in value to the entire economic output of the world. And this shortage of metals is forcing nations now to even abandon small coins, because the cost of the material itself, which is copper, is, you know, one of the main ingredients in coins, has become too precious. And it can be better used in other things because it's a conductor of electricity and whatnot. So the value of these metals that go into the coins is greater than the value of the smallest denomination coins, which is why all of these small coins are being abandoned elsewhere. Because this metal is so valuable and so precious, it can be put to better use elsewhere. So never mind that we cannot return to a gold standard or even a silver standard. We can't even get enough copper, for God's sake, to keep producing all these small coins. Now, you have to also remember that while gold output growth since 1950 has kept pace with world population growth, because they have both doubled, it has fallen behind world economic growth by at least 8 times. In other words, the economy has grown 8 times faster in the past 60 years than the amount of gold that we extract from the ground, which is why we had to abandon the gold standard in the 70s, when this, you know, this huge discrepancy became painfully evident. So the skeptics who argue that the value of gold could be artificially raised to equal that of all economic output, this is complete idiocy, because in that case, a gold bar would have to cost millions of dollars or yen or euros. So why bother doing that? If you can agree to accept, you know, the artificial valuation of gold to such exorbitant sums of money, then why not agree to accept the artificial value of paper or straw or cow dung for that matter? So fiat currencies recognize this conundrum, and they spare us from having to amass these unimaginable quantities of gold and then stockpile them in the vaults of central banks to just sit there for nothing, in perpetuity, to no good at all, which is a complete waste of human and material resources. So you see, money has no intrinsic value other than what is agreed upon by convention.
Well, this is the exact same reason why the original gold holders and things of that nature started to write out gold receipts instead, because lugging around bags of gold became impractical, and that was the very beginning of fiat money. They realized thousands of years ago, at the time before gold was even frickin' started to be seen as something you wouldn't really want to be having around in your pocket. They realized even then that fiat currency was a better system.
And they needed them for international transactions, for, you know, long distance trade. Yes, of course. It's a logical solution to a physical problem, to a real problem. So now the money today has no intrinsic value other than what is agreed upon by convention. And to agree upon the value of money requires trust in the system, but also requires faithful and universal respect for this system, for its rules, by every nation on earth. This is why no nation on earth is allowed to break this system, because this is what fundamentally, essentially maintains the peace. If this system breaks down, this monetary system, this monetary coercion system, then countries will not be able to access resources, that are you know, absolutely necessary, and then they have to go to war to take by force what they can't access by purchasing them.
And they do.
Yes. So, but this, there's several problems with this too. Let me just continue explaining here. What is required in this system, right, is trust. This is entirely built on trust, not on hoarding gold, you know, in a vault and sitting on it and saying, yeah, look, you can trust me. I got all this gold here. Come and look at it. Trust, that's all that matters in this system. And the ability to agree and to consent that we respect the value of this money and we respect each other's money. But then so the next logical step in this process is to do away with physical money altogether, which is exactly what is happening and has been happening increasingly since the end of World War II. Because you have to keep in mind that the vast majority of financial transactions nowadays and for the past 30 years occur electronically and not by physically transferring large quantities of money, you know, be it coins or banknotes. So they occur by physical
transfer. Except if you're the CIA or a major cocaine dealer.
Yes, but that's beside the point.
But the CIA are major cocaine dealers, so that kind of cancels each other out. I'm sorry, Kevin, keep going.
They're the only ones still dealing in you know, in truckloads of cash still. So nowadays, all these huge transfers of money for international transactions occur electronically, and it's just points on a computer screen. That is how money is being moved from one jurisdiction to another, back and forth, back and forth. Physical money covers only a very, very small percentage of the overall economic activity. So that's why we're well on our way to being a cashless society. We are already, probably to the tune of 60%, a cashless society. All we have to do is accept the inevitable that we're going to move towards a digital global currency. And whatever physical currency is going to remain in place, it's going to be there only in case we're going to have some kind of meltdown of our computers and telecommunications network. But the advantages of this, you know, are great. There's no point discussing them right now because it doesn't fall within the ambit of this program. But we're moving towards a cashless society with a global digital currency, and there's, you know, the IMF and the Chinese and the Russians and everybody else already screaming, this is what we need.
And everybody will have a microchip with all their money on it, so if you get out of line with the bankers, they can just turn your chip off. Then you can't buy nothing, including food.
That's very interesting, because you see, once you have a cashless society, once you have a digital currency, right, built entirely on trust, you have to be able to distribute that money properly. So that means every human being has to be counted, has to be accessible, right? Has to be able to access the international monetary system. So it has to be part of the system. Otherwise, he or she will not be able to get the points, the electronic points necessary to purchase what they need. So that's why they want to have either some kind of face recognition technology or iris recognition, or implanting some kind of a chip, or we have a card, you know, a data card carrying with us that is that has all the data necessary, or the fingerprint and so on. And this is coming, it's coming. That's why it's so important now that we get control of the global governance level, so that this power is not manipulated and abused, and they're turning us into a complete sheep then. But there are tremendous advantages to a digital currency, and it is coming. The moves have already been made. What I want to explain, because it's very, very rather complicated, is that what the international community has accomplished so far, and you know what the overarching great goals of this globalization depopulation policy or world order axis have been, and there are three. The goals that they have accomplished, that they have pursued, and they're still being pursued because some of them are not fully accomplished. Now I'll explain our three. One is economic integration. Two is political centralization, and three is the demographic transition. And these are at the absolute core of of the international community. Let's start with number one, economic integration. Well, to achieve economic integration, we have seen that they had to put together an international monetary system, that they had to accept each other's currencies, that they had to tie each other's currency to the US dollar, that they had to facilitate free trade across borders, that in order to avoid taking resources by force and so on. So to achieve economic integration, what is required now is the impoverishment of the West, in a sense, and the enrichment of the rest. And this is a process that is ongoing and that transfers jobs, capital, and know-how from the developed world, where the population has started to shrink already, to the developing world, where the population is still growing. And this has robbed us in the West of economic stability and employment opportunities, and it has also robbed the developing world of control over their resources and of their native systems of social, of political, of economic, and of cultural organization. Because if the rest of the world is to function within this system, is to have currencies that have value, they have to have economies that are produced. And in order to produce anything competitive on this international market, you have to be able to compete with the West. That means you have to adopt the same kind of manufacturing techniques, the same kind of technology, and so on, and work 9-to-5 jobs. And the vast majority of the world is not used to this kind of lifestyle. This kind of lifestyle is dictated by the technology, by the consumer goods that we produce and consume. So what is in effect now occurring is a giant and global act of restitution by the West towards the rest. If you want a restitution for the sins of our fathers and forefathers, sins committed during past centuries, slavery, colonialism, conquest, exploitations, sins that have led to an unbridgeable wealth gap between the West and the rest. A wealth gap, by the way, that also developed because we in the West were the first to industrialize. So had we in the West, been asked to voluntarily pay restitution to the world for the sins of our fathers, and had our counterparts in the people in the non-Western world been asked to abandon the traditional ways of life for Western affluence, we and they would have undoubtedly refused. That is why we were never asked. And yet, you cannot have an international system based on monetary coercion and on a uniform economic system that allows everybody to access resources without homogenizing the world in this respect, at least in terms of economics, which is why economics has been at the forefront of global change. And this is why we have learned to hate bankers and the banks and debt and so on. So in the current context, the restitution that we in the West are paying is necessary to equalize wealth to an extent that is sufficient to achieve global monetary convergence. You cannot have global monetary convergence. You cannot have a global digital currency. You cannot have that unless all regions of the world have similar standards of living and similar rules and procedures and standards.
Yeah, because you can hardly expect somebody in a slum in Rio de Janeiro to be expected to have a cell phone, smartphone with a slash card chip and everything, right? When they don't even have running water.
And you can hardly expect an agrarian society, to trade on the international markets. They would have nothing to trade, nothing of value. They might trade a few potatoes, but that's not going to, pay the bills or allow them to access oil, which is expensive, and other, dwindling resources. That's why they're hurrying now, it's a crazy rush towards homogenizing, towards bringing the world, to a similar standard of living. So they are decreasing our standard of living in order to reduce our consumption levels. They are increasing the standard of living of the developing world. And in such a way, they're coming up in their consumption levels, we're coming down, and we're reaching, sort of a similar standard of living, which is why our generation in the West now is the first one ever to be poorer than our parents. Because this has been engineered. This impoverishment has been engineered in order to achieve this monetary convergence and in order for the world to have, you know, more sensible consumption patterns. And in order to close the gap between the huge consumption levels of the West, because we used to consume, you know, 40 times more resources here in North America than, let's say, people in Africa, and 20 times more than people in Asia. But this gap is closing, you know, relatively fast. So in the current context, the restitution that we are paying is necessary to equalize wealth to an extent that is sufficient to achieve global monetary convergence, which we need desperately. We need desperately for another reason. Why? As technology improves and advances, as digitization takes over, you know, jobs, replaces humans in the manufacturing process, more and more human beings are going to be displaced from the labor market. And the economy cannot employ people. Even though now, you know, they're trying to find far-fetched ways of employing people in the service economy. We have all these useless jobs and useless, you know, businesses in the service economy that are replicated all over the place. You know, gazillion different kinds of hamburger joints and that sort of stuff. They cannot employ people because people are displaced by these advanced manufacturing techniques. Now they can, the economy can produce more and more and more goods with fewer and fewer and fewer people at a time when the population is still increasing. So unemployment has become chronic and it's going to get worse and worse and worse. But how do you allow people in a fully monetized economy, right, which is all the industrial countries, all countries in the world and all societies in the world, with the exception of agrarian societies, are fully monetized economies. People cannot survive in these environments unless they have a job. And now the economies, the society cannot offer jobs to people. So what do you do? This is why now you have, you know, in the United States, 45 million people on food stamps and, you know, money that is being given by the government, if you want, because these people cannot be employed. And more people will not be able to be employed. So now we need a fast transition, a desperate transition to a global currency, because only a global currency can enable the distribution of enough points, of enough money, for people who are no longer employed and that will never be employed to survive, to buy the necessary goods and services to survive despite being unemployed, despite not being productive members of society. It's a completely unprecedented situation. We've never had that before.
We've never had people trying to dumb down the global population and reduce its fertility before either.
Yes.
Maybe it's an unintended consequence. Maybe there used to be an entrepreneurial spirit within people and the ability to be independent and think for themselves and create jobs themselves. Now they need an employer or a government to do it for them because they've lost that ability.
But, you know, even at the best of times, Vinny, before, you know, we were poisoned to stupidity and apathy, even at the best of times, entrepreneurs were a very small minority of the population. You know, it takes guts and it takes initiative and it takes intelligence and it takes courage and many other things to be an entrepreneur and succeed at it. Most people, they just want to work. They don't want to have to worry. They want to come home and, you know, at 5 o'clock, hang their hat, plant their butt on the couch and watch TV and eat potato chips. Mm. That's what most people want. Anyway, to be an entrepreneur, to run your own business, means you're going to have to work day and night. And you have all the responsibility on your shoulders and so on. Most people don't want that kind of responsibility. That's a reality we have to face.
That's true.
Now, to go back to the difficult explanations I was going through, analysis, if you want. What this form of, you know, of economic convergence requires that developing nations abandon their traditional forms of social, economic, and political organization, and that they adopt, in a sense, Western standards. They adopt, you know, this Western standard of living, this Western mode of living, which depends on technology, on manufacturing, on science, because that is what will provide the affluence necessary to compete for those resources on the international market, all of these people aspire. Everybody in the world, in the developing world, aspires to have Western standards of living, but they have no clue what that entails. They don't know the high cost and sacrifices of a Western type life. They don't, you know, they don't know you have to work 9 to 5 and you have to be a slave to the economy and you have to move wherever the jobs are and so on. So this is why everybody in the developing world is screaming, you are destroying our societies, you know, you're tearing us apart. We don't want your Western lifestyle, but they want the Western goods. They want the affluence, and they need to access oil, and they need to access resources in order to obtain this affluence. So you see that, you know, we're blaming each other here when, in fact, our problems are so deep, and they're caused by, you know, structural problems, by outdated systems, by the fact that we have this readjustment of an economy from an economy of nation states to a global economy, and on and on. There's so many factors here involved. Now, political centralization. This is the other, you know, huge objective that has been pursued, you know, little by little, and actually by necessity, because you cannot agree on global rules of trade and so on without having some form of political discussions or some kind of forum where you can make the political decisions and come to an agreement internationally. So political centralization is in effect a byproduct was necessitated by this economic integration that has been pursued. But to achieve political centralization, which is a process that is still ongoing and is by no means complete, has required divesting national assemblies of power and investing international organizations with the authority to dictate to national assemblies. And this has robbed us, you know, citizens, voters, has robbed us of the right to self-determination, at least in many aspects of our lives, especially international trade.
It's kind of like a Venus flytrap in a way. It's got something nice and sticky and gooey that everybody loves the smell of, and as soon as they get there, it slowly closes and digests you. Kevin Galilee is my guest, and we'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. We're sponsored, of course, by The Range of Illusion, a Provinces novel by B. Holmes, A Story of Secrecy, A Saga of the Self, A Citizen's Search for Truth. Also, another book on the website, we have The Crowdfunding Revolution by Kevin Lawton. We've done an interview and a YouTube video with him there as well. I encourage you to check that out. Plus, check out the affiliates, Rush FM, that has stations in New Zealand from Auckland down to Tauranga and Taupo. So check that out on the home site there. And Ifinity FM for the South Island listeners. And also remember our sponsors, the High Tea Cafe, and especially that gourmet soap kitchen. Keep yourselves clean in a dirty, filthy world, ladies and gentlemen, for that gourmet soap kitchen in Wagga Wagga. And she's a lovely lady. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. You got to love this place. Kevin was elaborating there about certain economic, political, and centralization processes going on. And I see that just happening here in New Zealand. We've got the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that's going to bind all of our nations to the rule of corporations. We've had the Super City legislation, which has bound 9 different independent local councils around the Auckland region into one all-powerful council. Liverpool with the Lord Mayor who gets to pick his hand-picked unelected cabinet, which is incidentally shelling out all of the city's resources into private contracting, incidentally run by people who are beneficiaries of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. So you see the centralisation, you see this call for unionisation, and this is going to allow us to slot nicely into this new world order that we're talking about, or the scumbaggery world order, as I like to call it. Kevin, welcome back.
Yes, if I may continue with the political centralisation process, as I was explaining, the national assemblies have been divested of power, at least in certain jurisdictions. And international organizations have been invested with power that formerly belonged to national assemblies. And that was necessary, was necessitated by the fact that all of these countries, now 193 countries, had to find a common set of rules, had to find common ground to trade internationally, to keep the peace, to talk to each other, to solve problems. Now, of course, the problems run into all kinds of gamuts, you know, environmental, not just economic, political, and so on, military. And how do you do that? You know, obviously, you have to designate certain issues, international security prerogatives, say, and then you send, as a country, you send a few representatives to push for the interests of your country, but at the same time to discuss the global issues and come to an agreement with all of the other member states. So now they've created by necessity an international political infrastructure, and this international political infrastructure has robbed us, you know, nation states, of self-determination in specific areas. And that is why democracy has been replaced with plutocracy. That is to say, the rule of the people has been displaced by the rule of a dominant minority. And it was not necessarily because it was intended that way. It's out of need. Imagine you have 193 countries now. And if you were to send all of the MPs, all of the members of parliament of every country to this international forum, to this international government, if you want, it would be complete mayhem. You would have, you know, tens of thousands of politicians there trying to reach consensus on something. So obviously it's not practical. You cannot work that way. So it was by necessity that this, you know, that the international superstructure became plutocratic rather than democratic, or at the very least so limited in its membership that is, you know, even though democratic about between the few members, the privileged members who are representing the countries there, it's not democratic for the rest of us because we don't have a voice there. And yet this political centralization is necessary in order to complete the transition from a world organized according to the interests of nation states to a world organized around common global interests. Without the political and institutional infrastructure to carry out this process, there can be no coordinated and peaceful action. And humanity will forever remain separated by artificial borders and incapable of solving the material, the environmental, the political problems that threaten our very existence. The reality is that the will to accomplish global unity could not have been initiated, let alone coordinated, by the national assemblies of the world's 200 or some countries. All of them independent nation states, all of them with their own interests and with their own problems, narrow problems compared to the international problems. So someone had to forge ahead, and the elites did. Had we been asked to give up our hard-earned democracy for the dictates of global authorities that, although consensual in their decision-making process, are so limited in membership as to constitute plutocracy or UN autocracy for the rest of us, we would have never conceded. And that is why we were never asked. So this is, you know, this political centralization is as much the result of tactical requirements, if you want, as it is the result of the need to reduce the number of participants in order to come to some kind of conclusion, because you cannot have a discussion between 100,000 politicians. You have to restrict it to a very limited group. People can only interact with so many people. And that is the process of political centralization. But what this political centralization has allowed the world is to have now sort of concentric circles of jurisdiction. You know, you have now the international governance level with their own areas of jurisdiction. Yeah, and then you have the national governments with their own areas of jurisdiction. And then you have the regional ones, and then you have the local ones. And they try to stay out of each other's way so that things work smoothly. And the fact that you have this separation of power, you know, from the international superstructure to the national, to the regional, to the local, this is what enables the people at the global governance level to pull strings and to force, you know, national assemblies to do what they want them to do, despite the voters' interests and the voters' complaints and objections. And yet that is the only way you're going to keep the peace between all of these nations, all of them with their conflicting cultures and political systems and, you know, histories and animosities towards others and so on. It has been a very, very difficult process, but here we are, and for better or worse, you know, they are keeping the peace. And the best thing we can hope for is, and we have to do now, is to make sure that we get control of the global governance level, that we democratize that. And now that it is in place, we can do it. The third objective of the international community, which is, you know, the most difficult, because it's the one that has required the most immoral, unethical, criminal decisions, if you want, is the demographic limitations that they had to impose on the world, because we live on a planet with finite resources. There are no new continents to discover. We cannot send our excess population anywhere, you know, to open up new agricultural fields and to populate, you know, new continents. They don't exist. So the demographic limitations, you know, now we've reached the limits of the planet, and now we have to learn how to live within those limits. And in order to do that, they knew there was no other way but to make sure that the population stops growing. Well, and since we have already outgrown our resources, they have to ensure that the population shrinks. Mm. So to ensure that we break free from the cycle of poverty, that we live within the planet's ability to regenerate itself, and that we don't resort to wars of necessity, which is what has trapped us, you know, for millennia in conflict, followed by conflict, and that we don't exhaust the world's resources that belong to future generations, and that we also leave behind a world that is, you know, clean and with a healthy environment, not a world denuded to our children and to future generations. And that to ensure that we restore balance between nature and human civilization. All of these has required that we undergo a brutal process of defusing the population bomb and shrinking our numbers. And this process started in 1945 and is ongoing. And everything, absolutely everything, including our survival, hinges on its completion. And this process is euphemistically known as the demographic transition. And at its core, it is at the core of the international community because it represents the obverse and the hidden side of globalization. And what this process requires in order to reverse population growth and stabilize the global population, which is a completely unnatural process, as I had explained, what this process requires is our secret poisoning with chemical, biological, bacteriological agents that cause mass sterility and selective morbidity. This process also requires psychosocial and economic manipulations that undermine the family structure so as to suppress and inhibit the formation of large families. That's why we no longer have, you know, families with 10 children, like used to be the case. And this process has done untold damage to the genetic and intellectual endowment of humanity. This process has come to be covert and heartless because insurmountable obstacles stood in the way of legislating family size. And I explained those insurmountable obstacles, you know, in my books and in our previous interviews. But to make a long story short, there were three. In 1945, there were no birth control methods available. The political process, the democratic process, made it impossible for politicians to stand in front of the electorate and say, if you elect me, you know, I'm going to introduce population control and limit your family size. No politician would get elected on a platform like that. So that was the second insurmountable obstacle. And the third one was the intractability of religious authorities, and especially the Catholic Church, which committed itself early on to an absolutely no contraceptives. We don't allow the use of contraceptives. We don't allow abortion and so on. And I can understand, you know, the reluctance to abort, and I'm fully on board there in this respect with the Catholic Church. But there's absolutely no need to stand in the way of legitimizing and encouraging the use of contraceptives. So those three insurmountable obstacles stood in the way to legislation. So that's why they drove the depopulation, a population control program, underground. It was driven underground by these three structural obstacles, not because there are some demonic group of, you know, of skull and bones fellows who were scheming behind the scenes there to kill humanity. That's not it. The world is a lot more complex than that. But this process of engineered demographic transition requires a subtle form of infanticide as well as a subtle form of matricide and patricide. This process has prevented the birth of 2 billion children, and it is about to speed up the death of 3 billion people. Brutal numbers, brutal goals. Had we been asked to give up our reproductive rights, to downgrade the intellectual and genetic endowments of our children, to condemn our parents and ourselves to illness and premature death in order to accomplish this demographic transition, we would have never agreed. And that is why we were never asked. That is why we were never asked. And that is why they're trying to keep this secret, because they have not accomplished the goal yet. The demographic transition is not accomplished. We are in phase four of the demographic transition, the last phase in the developed world. But in the developing world, they've just barely entered phase two. They are 50 years behind us.
It seems that they have no faith in us.
No, they don't. And also because they find that it is a lot easier to operate with just a limited number of insiders rather than try to convince and educate, you know, 7 billion people, which would be an ongoing process. And they would have to dedicate, you know, tremendous resources to educate the public and to reach consensus. So they said no once the process was going anyway, because it was driven underground due to these structural obstacles I just described. You know, the system was set in place, and it was much easier to just continue as they have done since 1945 rather than change course. And of course, they would never change course. These bureaucracies, unless forced into changing course, because these bureaucracies, you know, they have a life of their own. There's a lot of vested interest. You know, that's the way they're doing things. And to change a global system that operates on a need-to-know basis, it's just it would be a complete nightmare, right? And you cannot really change it. You have to completely rebuild it. You have to dismantle what is, and, you know, rebuild a new system that operates on a completely different premise, which is openness rather than secrecy. The existing system operates on secrecy. It depends on it. It's that is its most vital component. And now we would have to. It's like changing, you know, night into day. Now they have to operate according to openness and consensus and education rather than secrecy and, you know, behind the door agreements between a plutocratic minority and deception of the general public. So very difficult transition, but we are forcing it upon them, because there is no bloody way I'm going to allow them to poison my children into stupidity and sterility. We are far smarter than that. And if I can come to all these secrets on my own, and I have absolutely no training in economics or politics, and I'm an art historian, an architectural historian. That's what I do. I guess I discovered all this, and I have been able to patch together this complex puzzle because I'm a historian and I can look at the past. See, no, somebody who's caught in the present cannot see where we came from, cannot see all these long term trends, because they're used to just looking, you know, in their immediate surrounding and just, you know, analyzing the world according to what has happened for the past 10 years and what they think might happen in the next 5 years. So I guess it took a historian to do this, and here I am. But all these three achievements, economic integration, political centralization, and demographic transition, are the result of conscious decisions made by policymakers. Policymakers, not bankers. Bankers are just a small part of this. They're just responsible for the economic section of this global plan that incorporates every aspect of life: politics, economics, culture, communication, everything. All of these three goals are largely the result of consensus, not force. Consensus among the elites, because it was much easier to reach consensus on these difficult issues amongst a small group rather than, you know, involving the entire population. So the masses have been excluded in order to simplify and speed up this process, to make it efficient, but also in order to bypass democratic oversight and structural and systemic obstacles. And they had to bypass democratic oversight because it would have been impossible to get the assemblies of 200 nations to agree on these common denominators and the common plan. They would have been bickering and bitching and complaining and fighting back and forth over little details, and they would have lost themselves in the forest and would have accomplished absolutely nothing. So all of these three accomplishments are the result of deep, deep cooperation between professional groups that span every field of knowledge and every area of competence, and who have agreed to forge ahead under the cover of secrecy and by deception, knowing that it would be too difficult to talk sense into the masses, since few people have the intelligence to comprehend the complex issues, and most everybody lacks the time necessary to study the situation. And most people lack the desire to want to understand or to even want to have a role in forging the future.
Well, they could repeat it over and over. Continue, Kevin.
Most of us, let's face it, care only for immediate gratification, for fun in the present, you know, for having a good time with your neighbors and buddies and so on. And we give little consideration to the future. And these people have been asked to consider, they've been forced to consider the future of humanity 200 years in advance.
Well, I was going to suggest that they could indeed brainwash people through the media by repeating it over and over and over again, all the way out through all the channels every now and again, and use that to make everybody think that depopulation is a really good idea. So then when any voting or legislation or anything comes around, everybody would be totally happy to accept it. It'd be cool. It'd be part of the norm.
Well, you know something, this issue of depopulation runs very deep, because once you go down to the core of it, it involves allowing the government or authorities a place in your bedroom. You know, nobody wants to be regulated in their sexual activities, right, by anybody. This is a matter between husband and wife, and, you know, nobody wants a third wheel there saying, you know, hold on there, dude, keep it in your pants, not tonight. Sorry, you cannot have a kid, you know, for the next 5 years. Sorry, you cannot have you know, more than two kids, because that's the situation, the global situation, right? This goes down to our to the most basic and one of the most powerful instincts, the urge to procreate, and we all know how difficult that urge is to control.
Oh, yeah, but we've got pornography all over the place, so people are getting their sexual jollies without even having sex or even anywhere near like that. A man could easily spend his life never within reach of a woman and never go without one.
Yeah, and now that is possible now, because they've made sure that, you know, there is pornography available, so people can have release, if you want, relief. You know, in 1945, if you even talk about anything that's even remotely sexual, you would have been booked immediately in prison for under obscenity laws.
Ironically,
It's a different environment now. Now we can talk about these issues. Now this is considered a health issue, no longer an ethical issue.
You know, it reminds me of a Brave New World, because there's another consequence of this. Is not only do people maybe some people potentially have even less sex and have less desire for real sex as a result of the proliferation of pornography, but there's also a increased element possibly of promiscuity, so it would also increase sex for some and decrease it for others. So at the end of the day, you still need mitigating factors according to this philosophy of population reduction, don't you? Regardless.
Well, yes, and regardless of whether you fall under the category of a person with an increased sexual appetite because of this, everybody is far less capable of producing children, because our sperm is so, you know, so substandard than previous generations were, who had not been interfered with through covert chemical and biological methods. So, you know, even though people may have sex now more often than in the past, which I doubt that's the case, their sex is going to be fruitless because it will not result in a childbirth, in conception. So these are the problems. This is how the depopulation policy hangs together, or it relates to the globalization effort, and therefore to the effort of the international community to maintain peace and to ensure, or at least forge, you know, some kind of semblance of global prosperity and avoid war, so that we don't fall victim to three huge threats: the threat of nuclear annihilation, for one thing; the threat of mass global famine, two; and the third one, the threat of environmental devastation. These are the three threats that are hanging over our heads now, because we are in effect, in a sense, victims of our own success as a species. We're so successful. We've displaced every other species on Earth. We don't have any predators. We don't have any enemies. There's nobody to stop us. This is why only man can stop man, and this is why our governments have become our predators in a way. The international community, the United Nations, is the predator, in a sense, of humanity, because they are there to stop humanity from, you know, from spreading out of control and destroying everything that our lives and all life on Earth depends. So just imagine the paradox, right? This is a paradox of unprecedented proportions. But this is why I keep saying that what the United, all of these crimes, all of these horrible, odious crimes, these diabolical methods, have been committed fundamentally with good intentions, with benevolent intentions, not with bad intentions, not with malevolent intentions. Even though it's a very hard concept to grasp, but if they hadn't put together this force to stop humanity, right, we would have already self-destructed because we have nobody to stop us. Those are the realities we face. Now, from now on, from this generation onward, the notion that anybody will be able to have more than two children is going to be completely buried. Large families are done with. We're already at the, you know, beyond the limits of Mother Earth, and from now on, in perpetuity, for all times, families are going to be restricted to two. And might as well do it voluntarily, because if we don't do it voluntarily, they're going to poison us. And when they poison us, many of us will become completely sterile and will completely disappear. Mm. By taking responsibility and voluntarily saying, we're going to do this, you know, stop poisoning us, at least all of us will be able to continue our lineages. No family line need to be terminated. So we will democratize global governance, we will democratize this demographic process of shrinking the population and bringing the human civilization back, you know, in tune, in balance with Mother Nature.
I think we can do it quite easily the same way we've gotten people to stop smoking in Maine. It's just give everybody crap about it all the time, you know.
I know, Vinny, people are going to get this. You know, we're not stupid. This is not rocket science. This is not brain surgery. These are relatively simple things to grasp once you have a whole picture. Once we are given the facts and not, you know, being deceived into being ignorant and being confused, because the whole program has been geared towards deception and lie so that they can go ahead and do these things behind our backs, right? Now, the entire program has to be geared towards education, consensus, and responsible citizenship, but also towards building this this new ethic of a global consciousness. We all have to think now in global terms. In other words, we have to think what is good for the world, for future generations, not just what is good for John and Joe and for the city in which you live. That kind of mentality is completely gone. We can no longer hide behind national borders. We can no longer hide behind, you know, ethnic limitations and behind, you know, notions that this is my group and the whole world can go to hell. That mentality has to be buried. Otherwise, we're all going to hell.
Now, also, the world's getting a bit more dangerous place lately, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? You see the threats all around you. It's in your food. It's in the air. It's in the skies. It's on the ground. It's permeated and saturated every facet of our lives. And basically, we're going to be given now one thing we didn't have before all this stuff came around, a choice about whether or not we take responsibility so that these scumbags who are poisoning us no longer feel that they have to. Kevin Galilee has been my very special guest. What's your website there, Kevin, quickly?
People can find me on LinkedIn or on Facebook. Of course, since I've been imprisoned 6 times to stop me from bringing the truth, I have not been able to maintain my personal website. That I'm just, you know, putting back my life together again after 6 imprisonments and 10 months in exile and a year behind bars. But now I have earned, you know, this privileged position of being able to say what nobody in the world can say. No politician, no UN technocrat or bureaucrat. However, if people want to support us, we do need the public support at this time here in Rome to complete my task here to be able to force Pope Francis to speak up. And if anybody wants to donate a few dollars to our fund, I would appreciate it. And the donations link to that is www.gofundme.com/5fqttc. That's gofundme.com/5fqttc. And we don't need a fortune. We just need people to donate a few dollars so that we can stay here for as long as it takes to force Pope Francis to come clean, to change the church's policy, to allow contraceptive use, which would clear the way for secular institutions to bring the population control into the open and encourage people to use contraceptives rather than poison us behind our backs.
Yeah, that's right. Come clean, Pope Francis, promote the use of condoms. And this episode's been sponsored by the Crowdfunding Revolution, a book by Kevin Lawton and Dan Marum, The Range of Illusion by B. Holmes. Those books are on the websites there. Also, our little friendly sponsors, the High Tea Cafe and the Gourmet Soap Kitchen. Don't forget about Blue Shield as well, because one of the little depopulation methodologies is bathing you in radiation, because that doesn't make your swimmers work too well either. Thank you very much, Kevin Galilee. And also, on a side note, just to ramp up the show here, you posted a comment to me the other day on Facebook. Now, funnily enough, the day before, I'd been driving over to one of my mates' place to have a beer with him, and I was thinking in the car, like, because I don't have a radio, I'm forced to think when I drive. And so I was thinking, when I die, what I want to happen after I die is somebody to come up and say something and have saved a lot of lives, right? Like, saved a good bulk of people. And I want them, after I'm dead, to come up and say something along the lines of, you know, Vinny Eastwood, that guy, he talked to me one time when I was down in the dumps and when I was really feeling like crap and I was going to give up on trying to save people. I just couldn't do it anymore. It had been too much. And then he came along and he talked to me, and he made something that kind of like changed my mind about that. And I went on to save a lot of people's lives. And this is a comment you posted a day after I had that thought. I have the greatest respect for Vinny, and I look forward to our interview. Vinny is the first media person in the world to have the courage to offer me a podium from which to tell the world the bitter truths of the global depopulation policy. Had it not been for him, I may have never broken the ice and could have disappeared into oblivion. Vinny is one of a kind, and the world better start recognizing his extraordinary value. He is worth his weight in gold. No, correction, diamonds.
And I want to add something to that. You are far more important than any head of state in the world today, as am I, because we are the ones forging a global change. Their hands are tied. They have neither the courage nor the flexibility because they're caught within the system and they're waiting to be rescued by outsiders. We are the rescue team. We are the salvation. We are the second coming, if you want. That's how important you are, Vinny, and that's how important am I. And people have finally started recognizing this because this is something very difficult to wrap your head around. There is no book to follow. This is completely new knowledge. This is, and until now, also forbidden fruit.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And also bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, this show is listener supported. You are the ones who pay and ensure that this happens. There is only one rule when you donate to me. It doesn't matter how much or whatever you want to do. You can do whatever you want, $1 a month to $100 a month or $1,000, $10,000, whatever. Don't, under any circumstances, donate to me if your family's going hungry and if you don't have all your bills paid. Don't do it. I don't want to see any of you being put out there and actually making your own lives harder just to make my life easier. It defeats the purpose of what I'm trying to do here. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening.